For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, bringing you our 200th readout video. So thank you very much to everybody who's watching, including a shout out to Charlotte, North Carolina, which is number 48 on our audience city list. And in this video from my free Wednesday Wake Up email newsletter, to which you should subscribe in case we get deplatformed despite the recent and gratifying enthusiasm for our videos, we hail the energy transition. Not us. Nature hails the energy transition, as in the Fighting Jays Solar Farm in Fort Bend County, Texas, was smashed up by a hailstorm on March 15th. So now, not only is the power unavailable, with a costly and potentially time-consuming repair job that won't make it any better able to handle the next storm, the bits and pieces are scattered around, and they're environmentally nasty. And Canada's richly subsidized, poorly watched, all-in-on-climate alarmism state broadcaster, the CBC, is also reporting that, quote, Drake Landing, once the leading solar heating community of its kind in North America, may have to rely on fossil fuels as the aging system is breaking down and may be too expensive or impossible to fix, end quote. So, what if it were the whole country? Now there's an ugly thought. And then we say, hold on a second. Because the people who keep warning us that we are destroying the planet often forget how easy their flim-flam is to spot. For instance, a headline in Nature, the magazine not the phenomenon, says, quote, climate change has slowed Earth's rotation and could affect how we keep time. The effect of melting polar ice could delay the need for a leap second by 3 years, end quote. Right. The Earth is incredibly colossally huge and complex, weighing some 5.927168 sextillion tons, rotating on its axis at around 1,600 kilometers per hour, while orbiting the Sun at a staggering 107,000 kilometers per hour. Not only that, but its spin is eccentric, helping cause the so-called Milankovitch cycles. It is affected by its unusually large moon, its core is dynamic in ways we don't really understand, most of these measurements are approximations, and we know that Arctic ice has been shrinking and expanding in an irregular natural cycle since long before the invention of the polar bear. So, take all these facts and declare that we alone have caused a change that can be measured to the precision of 1 second in 3 years. That is pure spin, though also a very wobbly spin. And it depends, as usual, on people not reading past the headline, which you sometimes think the journalists who wrote the story didn't do either. Hi everybody, and especially our new subscribers. We've been asking you to help us get to 100,000. We were at 84,000, and we're now over 91 because more than 7,000 people clicked the button in April alone. And I know we have a lot of new viewers too, so if you're watching, but you're not yet a subscriber, please do click here. It's free, it helps us grow the channel, it protects us against getting deplatformed, and it makes sure that you hear about the latest videos. So to the new subscribers, welcome aboard, and for everybody, back to the show. In the newsletter, we also note sadly that you just can't win with climate alarmists. It's hard to know whether Euronews.Green was sobbing or exulting, but they certainly were claiming that, quote, planting trees in the wrong places could be contributing to global warming, study reveals, end quote. And it's full of the usual cliches like, quote, trees are known for their ability to soak up planet heating carbon dioxide, end quote. No longer just warming, please note, heating, stand by for scorching. But, alas, quote, researchers have discovered that in a number of cases, too many trees in one area means that less sunlight is reflected back from the Earth's surface, and in turn, more heat is absorbed by the planet, end quote. And heaven forbid that we should just let messy natural forests spring up in response to rising atmospheric CO2, because nature, the phenomenon, has no idea what it's doing. Also, we note a curse on those stupid foreigners who keep showing up in Canada wanting to buy our LNG, also known as liquefied natural gas or methane, as a superior fuel to, say, coal, only to have our government pat them on the head and say, no, there's no business case. You just think you're here with a sack of cash. The latest dolt to do so is Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis, who came and prated at Justin Trudeau about how keen the Greeks are for this fuel, but Trudeau put him in his place, which seems to be an American port where they're keen to sell the stuff. Oh, and Canary Media credulously emails, U.S. green steel is coming, because, quote, U.S. pledges up to $1 billion for two pioneering green steel projects, end quote. Red ink is coming, we say. But apparently not food, at least not tasty food. Everything you love to eat and drink will soon be gone due to climate change or possibly self-inflicted climate paranoia. According to Love Food, the latest victim of the climate cult spreading to every corner of society that once brought simple joy and peace, quote, there's nothing like a chilled glass of Prosecco to help you unwind after a busy day. But scientists have warned that the future of the crowd-pleasing fizz, as well as some of the world's most celebrated wines, is at risk due to climate change, end quote. In fact, they say, everything nice is going to die, including coffee, almonds, blueberries, broccoli. Well, some people think broccoli is nice. Also honey, quote, another product that may soon cease to exist, end quote, unless it doesn't. And all other wine, avocado, and check for yourself. Salmon, maple syrup, blah, 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 oranges, chocolate, pasta, and Tabasco sauce. So, what's not on the list? You guessed that too. Poison ivy, sumpweed, thistles, skunk cabbage, basically anything disgusting or harmful except tofu. So, the alarmists won't have to make us give up food to save the climate. It will all die anyway. And speaking of dying, as the deadlines get ever closer on this fabled green energy transition, companies are discovering that pretending to believe in it has backed them into a dangerous corner. They promise to be green, carbon neutral, and virtuous, and now for some strange reason, the activists who goaded them into promising it so that they could stop getting pestered are demanding that they follow through, or something a lot worse than mere pestering will result. In Canada, for instance, it means aggressive antitrust action against people who thought that spouting green boilerplate would exempt them from actually having to do anything. It turns out that you do have to do something, but if you do what they say, you will lose all your money and go out of business. So, there's an old saying that he who would sup with the devil must have a long spoon, and companies are being surprised at just how long the reach of a meddlesome, sanctimonious state is and how slippery its reasoning. Also, how monomaniacal. The Canadian government is in a lot of trouble with its NATO allies for being such a deadbeat on defense, not to mention apparently leaning toward Hamas even more than the Biden administration. But fear not, we are alert to the real security threats. Thus, Prime Minister Trudeau, who's actually cutting defense while spewing cash in every other direction as though debt didn't carry interest, has found some cash for the good stuff. As Tristan Hopper complains in the National Post, quote, as part of a surprise outlay of cash announced at a summit in South Korea, the Prime Minister's office has approved $8.4 million to study how autocracy thrives in warning temperatures, end quote. Well, sure, one of the lessons of history, of course, is that Hitler and Stalin seized power in a heat wave. Something. In the newsletter, we also continue our Getting Worse series by looking at extreme wetness in the U.S. One thing experts claim to know for sure about climate change, or journalists and politicians claim that experts claim to know for sure, is that warmer air can hold more water. So, if it gets warmer, extreme levels of rainfall must go up. And the convenient thing about a prediction like that is that if a bad storm happens, the scientists can point to it and say, see, told ya. But if nothing happens, they can just say nothing at all and wait for the next one, because sooner or later, it's going to rain hard somewhere. And if this one hasn't happened, it's still bound to, and then they can pounce. Unfortunately, as we've pointed out many times, we are well into the era in which scientists say climate impacts are now visible, or again, journalists and politicians say that they say it. And while the alarmists have been moving around the date in the past at which anthropogenic climate change supposedly took over, if we look over the whole of the 20th century, we should surely see whatever effect they're warning about somewhere. And indeed, in the case of extreme rainfall, the NOAA keeps a record of the monthly percentage of areas in the U.S. which were classified as very wet going back to 1895 and coming up to the present. Sure enough, there's an upward trend, but it's an insignificant 0.001% per year. Yes, that's right, 1/1000th of 1%, which looks like this. A trend that small is statistically no different from zero, meaning, to their grave disappointment, it's not getting worse. In the newsletter, we also delve into the Holocene temperature conundrum, the title of a peer-reviewed paper published in 2014 by a group of scientists from around the world led by Zhengyu Liu of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who pointed out a problem that, once they explained it, makes us wonder first why no one had mentioned it before, including the IPCC, and second, why the media ignored the paper at the time and ever since. No, we're just kidding. We don't wonder at all, because here's the problem. Paleoclimate reconstructions show that after the end of the last glaciation, the world warmed up for a few thousand years until the mid-Holocene, which is about 6,000 years ago, and then it spent the next six millennia gradually cooling until the 20th century warming. But over the past 8,000 years, CO2 levels in the atmosphere were rising. And climate models say that CO2 is the control knob on the global thermostat. So, the world should have been steadily warming the whole time, not cooling. The models predict one thing, and the data show that the opposite happened, not just over a decade or two, which might be a fluke, but over 6,000 years, six millennia. CO2 and temperature persistently refused to correlate. So, why has it been ignored? Because in climate science, unlike the normal kind, if the data doesn't fit the theory, you ignore the data. Nothing to see here, folks. Move along. Sky on fire. Film at 11. And as usual, we conclude the newsletter with a trip into the CO2science.org archive, this time for a paper published in 2010, whose authors write that, quote, "The trend in global surface temperatures has been nearly flat since the late 1990s, despite continuing increases in the forcing due to the sum of well-mixed greenhouse gases, CO2, CH4, halocarbons, and N2O, end quote, making them wonder if we really know what drives climate change. So, they then zeroed in on observations of stratospheric water vapor concentration from 1980 to 2008, since water vapor is a key greenhouse gas, and they matched it against near-surface air temperature. What they learned was, mostly, that the situation is unclear. Which might sound disappointing, but when everyone is saying the science is settled, it's very important to discover that it's not, including that we don't know nearly enough about how climate works to predict what cutting CO2 emissions will accomplish, if indeed it will accomplish anything. For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, and when people tell me solar energy is reliable, I think they don't know what the hell they're talking about.